When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
I mean, you saw yesterday, I sent basically the thing, like what I think were my 10 most important movies, and I sent a few movies where they really inspired me, and I think they are masterpieces. Of course, the list is bigger.
Sure.
But they were just out of my ass, basically.
Yeah, that's kind of, that would be a good motto for the show.
Yeah.
Out of our ass. In fact, that might be a better title than Trailers from Hell.
Too late now.
Too late. But anyway, so we are here this week. I should start over. Hi, I'm Josh Olson, and you're listening to The Movies That Made Me, the official podcast of Trailers from Hell. I'm here as ever with the great Joe Dante, and our guest this week is a filmmaker who, if I can speak freely, has a reputation that may or may not be deserved. My specific kind of radicalizing experience with him was many years ago. There was a screening of a movie he made called Postal at a screening room in Hollywood. And my friend Daniel Waters, the screenwriter, the two of us went off to see it. And I'm looking this gentleman in the eye when I say this. We went, I will admit, to go kind of laugh. And we knew he was going to be there doing an interview. And we thought this will be an interesting train wreck. And we saw Postal. And our jaws hit the floor. It was a brilliant, dark, twisted, very political comedy. And the filmmaker in question gave a really entertaining and intelligent interview with the Q&A afterwards, and I think won almost everybody over. I am talking of the fascinating and wonderful Uwe Boll, who is here with us in Skype, actually.
Hello.
Actually, where are you? Are you in Canada? Or you're...
Vancouver.
Vancouver, okay.
Yeah.
But that movie really kind of rocked my world, because you walked in, and I'm sure you're no stranger to what your reputation was at that point. And here's this guy making a movie that is so out of the mainstream and so smart. I wish I could take credit for this line. My friend Dan said, it's the 9/11 movie that America deserves. And I have to agree. He's gone on to make many other films. One that really also kind of affected me was he made a movie called Assault on Wall Street that I was just discussing with Joe and Don here beforehand. Pretty much every screenwriter I know has been brought in to pitch ideas on the Death Wish movie over the years. And I know I'm not the only one who has suggested to the various incarnations of producers on this thing that street crime is not really that big a deal anymore, that if you really want to tap into the zeitgeist, you need to have your guy be someone whose wife, say, was killed by an insurance company and he goes after Wall Street. And they would always go, oh, nice idea, and then move on. Well, you made that film. You made Assault on Wall Street, which is, again, that I think I've sort of summed up the plot, but a very smart, dark, political action film, very entertaining. You've gone on to make a series of more kind of political action films, the Rampage series, which are also very, very entertaining and very smart. But you have this sort of overall reputation that I think keeps a lot of people away from those films. And I'll be honest, there's an agenda here. My hope is in the conversation about the movies that have inspired you, we can kind of wake people up to the fact that there's a lot more to you than maybe some people think. I've been talking a lot. I apologize. Is that...
No, I mean, I started in Germany with a few movies, and the first one was German Fright Movie. It was basically, in a way, inspired by Kentucky Fried Movie. And we did a German version with almost no money. And it was actually received very well. And we made even money in the movie theaters with it. And then I did a movie, Barschel, Murder in Geneva, what was basically about, it's a political case in Germany where an actual prime minister of a German state got found dead in the bathtub in Geneva, 1987. And it turned out, so they counted a suicide. It was officially a suicide, but he got poisoned, a little like what Putin is doing now. And he was in the same hotel at the same time was the son from Ayatollah Khomeini and various Eastern German agents. And we went down to basically Geneva in CERN. We made the movie. We got like our telephones got taped in between. So we heard echoes, whatever we changed, we figured out. And our solution is that there was a political, a real murder case, right? So, and because he turned out 10 years later, after my movie, it turned out he was very involved in weapon deals with Eastern Germany as a West German politics. There was a lot of bribery going on. And in the times of the Cold War, I don't want to talk too long about it, but it's an interesting story. In the Cold War, you can say that Eastern Germany delivered weapons to all the communist countries, and Western Germany delivered weapons to all the more NATO-friendly countries. They divided it up, but they made together money on it. And because Eastern Germany needed West German currency, because their currency was worthless, basically. So that movie tanked totally. And I thought that this is the end of my film career, because I got also political flag. And then I made one more German movie, Run Amok, where I basically have a guy running amok. You never see the police, you just see him. And it's the last 25 minutes of the movie is Richard Strauss' Totenverklärung Symphony with the Berlin Symphony Orchestra in a slow-mo amok run. It was basically me saying goodbye to the film industry. Because I never got subsidies in Germany, I was always an outsider. So I felt like if that was it, I go with a bang. And I think the movie is extremely good, but it's totally artificial, right? I mean, I never saw something like this before. I mean, 25 minutes in slow motion. And if you ever listen to Richard Strauss' Totenverklärung, he did the Also sprach Zarathustra, also what you know from 2001, right? It's mm-hmm. the same composer.
Yeah.
But that it's about death. That it's the biggest, most bombastic symphony ever done in the history of music. So if you ever have a chance to see that in the New York Philharmonic or the Berlin or Vienna, that is something what puts like any Hollywood composer into the dust. Because you have like in the end of the last 8 minutes of that symphony, you have like 120 musicians all playing every instrument in full force. And it's an amazing thing. And that specific symphony was my biggest inspiring music I always listened to when I wrote, when I was a kid, when I was like, I started writing very early and when I went to university and studied literature and so on, it was very inspiring for me. And then about when you talk about inspiration, when I got all the negative reviews and the golden raspberries for my video game based movies, like House of the Dead, Alone in the Dark, Blood Rain, I was kind of okay, but I got that movie's financed.
Right.
You know, I never got subsidies, what Wim Wenders gets in Germany or all that other directors. So I had to raise money for my movies, and I was in a dead end, like with my more arthouse movies, whatever, nobody made any money on it. And then House of the Dead, the Sega video game, came out of the blue, basically, and I was able to finance it, and it actually generated millions of dollars in profit on our account, not only on Lionsgate's account or whatever, on our account. And that we all know is very rare in the film industry, that as a filmmaker, you actually like double your money and you can show your investors, you know what you made? You made 100%. Yeah, and so that opened more investments in my movies. And so, but at the same time, it moved the way my reputation moved away totally to I'm a trash filmer. I'm Ed Wood. I'm, you know, like I'm an idiot and whatsoever. So, and it I was upset about it. I was fighting back. That was the biggest mistake, you know, when you, I never had a Hollywood agent, management, PR company, whatever, you know, when like, here, what is the fat guy from Austin? Harry Knowles. So you know, he trashed me to the garbage, right? And I told him, like, you're just, for me, a fat fucking asshole. You have no clue from film history, you know, like, I mean, I grew up, there was only like cinema, right? So there was, there were no TV cable channels, no Netflix, whatever. I watched Romero's Dawn of the Dead or Once Upon a Time in the West from Sergio Leone or whatever. I watched Apocalypse Now, The Deer Hunter, whatever. I watched that in the movie theaters. That was my education, film education. Like from Ingmar Bergman movies to Pasolini to I went and watched them, you know, and so to tell me I have no clue from film history is laughable. Well, you know, it's like, it was for me always laughable. That was the reason I was so aggressive about it, because I really watched thousands of movies. I know from Potemkin, from Eisenstein, whatever. I really know from the ground up what happened in the film industry. And it's not like my filmography or film knowledge as we have now in Hollywood starts with Star Wars.
Right.
Or people think that is an important movie or whatever, you know? So that is the thing. It's like, it's for me, like, you know, when you ask average people, Orson Welles, they will say Citizen Kane, you know, but they were not like, The House Amberson, whatever, they don't know Othello, what Macbeth, whatever, they don't know all these other movies because it's just something they snap out of Instagram or whatsoever. So, you know, and that was why I was unhappy. And I think also later I made that other movies with Posters, Sound of War, Street Rampage. I made a movie about Darfur, the genocide in Darfur, you know, stoic about a prison situation where three people tortured and raped the guy over the weekend. We played it all in one prison cell, and they had the actors, they had to stay in the prison cell for the duration of the movie. It was Edward Furlong is in it, the son from Barry Levinson is in it. It's an amazing movie. I never got any credit or whatsoever. You know, like the only money I ever made was with the stupid video game-based movies, and everything else got completely ignored or even bashed. And so it was a very frustrating like last 12 years.
I can imagine while you were talking about music, by the way, Don, our engineer, who's a great composer himself, a musician, was nodding along in agreement. So, but that seems like a great way to segue into, you know, let's talk about the movies that kind of inspired you coming up. I'm also interested, you didn't, here in America, we had, you know, pre-cable, we had, you know, a few TV channels, and they would run old black and white movies. So if you were a kid of a certain age, you know, it was almost forced upon you. But you're saying you didn't have that. You actually had to go to theaters as a kid to.
No. I went. There was one movie theater in Buchscheid, small town where I'm coming from by Cologne, and they had matinees every Saturday and Sunday, and they showed only like. And my parents, I was 6-7, and I walked alone to the movie theater. My parents just, okay, I watched the matinee. I had no clue what was coming. But there was like Mutiny of the Bounty, Quo Vadis, Ben-Hur, like movies like this. And I was like the whole Sunday, because they were mostly also like 3-4 hours long.
Right.
Lawrence of Arabia, whatever. So I watched all of this. But in a movie, in the TV at that point, we had also two channels, and they showed classics. Hmm. But they were all at 10 p.m., right? I was too small. I mean, you kind of like, you know, and then later when I was 11, 12, 13 years old, I dealt with my mother and said, look, let me watch that movie. I know it's from 10 to 12, but whatever, I sleep in the afternoon at hour. So I was able to watch stuff in TV too, but mostly the daytime stuff was kids stuff. and I was not really into this anymore. And I will never forget, I was like 12 and dealt with my mother that I can watch Rosemary's Baby. And I was so shocked, I couldn't sleep for 3 days. Because I was, my parents were already sleeping, and I was like completely scared shitless. But for example, what I loved was on the Saturdays, I could sleep at my grandma's house. My grandpa was already dead, but I could sleep in her house. And she always let me watch the Western in TV in the Saturday evening. And it was, so I watched from, of course, El Dorado, Rio Grande, all the John Ford, the Howard Hawks Western, John Huston, you know, so Treasure of Sierra Madre. So you watched a lot of, at that point, the TV really picked the good stuff, right, you know, right. How the West was won. So I watched all that Western classics from hundreds of them. Over the years, and loved it. I still love Western, and I'm always happy if from time to time a new Western comes out. Not a lot getting done, but I think it's a great genre.
Absolutely agreed. Well, why don't we? You've got a list of the 10 sort of movies that most inspired you. Is that the if you want to sort of start at the bottom and work your way up, well, we can kind of get a feel for.
I mean, I would say as the initial movie, what made me, I want to make movies, is Mutiny of the Bounty, and not the old one with Clark Gable, the Marlon Brando.
On December 23rd, 1787, His Majesty's ship Bounty sailed from England, bound for the South Seas. En route, there began a fantastic series of historical events, culminating in the most famous mutiny in history. The dramatic story of that mutiny has, for more than a century, excited the imagination of men, women, and children the world over.
Oh. Not the... I don't know what.
Not the Mel Gibson one.
Other yeah, shitty ones, whatever. But the Marlon Brando one, because I felt like, oh, I want to do this. I want to make movies. I want to be in the Caribbeans. I want to have adventures. I want to be like travel through the world and doing movies like this. I watched it in the movie theater, came back home, told my mother I want to make movies. And it was also kind of so that I started reading about movies or directors or genres when I was like 11, 12. I started reading books about it, right? So, and when you had later the Truffaut book about Hitchcock, whatever, all that stuff, Krakauer and James Monaco, how movies getting made, all that early stuff. So I read all of this too. And I never lost the interest for like being just watching a movie, being fascinated, and at the same time getting a little more background info about it. And I think one of the, if I go to like movie number two, would be Jaws.
Aha!
because it was also this guy, I think it's just a sensational movie. And I think a real good movie, you can only see 20, 30 years later, you can really judge this. And Jaws is a movie I can watch every year without being bored.
Yeah.
And it's like just hooked to it. You just like watch it, and it's just like engaging. A real genre movie with great actors, great directing, without all the CGI. You know, like, I mean, we all know the disastrous shooting situation of Jaws. Yeah. But I think it was a very inspiring movie for me also in regards of doing genre, and not only like dramas or comedy. And I just loved Jaws because it was this kind of, everybody was scared shitless in the movie theater. And that was also way before social media, way before you could have any information. So you only know, oh, it's a Steven Spielberg film, it's Jaws now. And then you see the opening and you're already like, oh God. Yeah, so right. a great movie. And I think a movie what still delivers.
Yeah, I agree. And I want to take advantage of the fact that we've got two directors here. Joe.
No waiting.
What?
Two directors, no waiting. That was
two directors, no waiting.
Slogan on my first film, which had a co-director.
One of the things that has always fascinated me is that I can think of few things that exist on the planet right now other than that are more terrifying than sharks. And they're just frightening creatures.
You and Trump.
And, well, okay, fine.
No, he's afraid of sharks.
He's, oh, is he?
Yeah.
What, you're not?
Shark phobia. No, I don't spend that much time in the water. I'm afraid of piranhas.
a good fear. But come?
In internet right now is a new trailer, a new Jason Statham movie with a huge shark.
Oh, yeah, the Meg.
The Meg. That script.
Yeah, but it looks like absurd, right?
That script has been floating around for
years. 20 years.
Yeah. And everybody turns it down because it's so stupid. And yeah, yet, finally, they managed to find the money.
Well, I hope they fix the script. But I guess what's fascinating to me, because seriously, I can't imagine anything easier than making a movie in which a shark is a terrifying presence. And yet...
It'd be a lot easier to do it if you didn't see the shark.
Well, clearly. But it's fascinating to me that for such a terrifying creature, there's really only one genuinely frightening shark movie. Why is that?
Well, there have been shark movies.
But they're not scary.
Well, because they didn't have the resources, for one thing. And it's based on a book that's pretty well structured. The other pictures, there's a Sam Fuller movie called Shark,
yeah,
which has a shark scene in it. Because
right.
That wasn't the real title. There's Blue Water, White Death, which is a documentary. And there's the shark Fighters with Victor Mature, where
you don't
see the shark very much. You see the fins. The fins tend to stand in for the sharks in mm-hmm. most of those movies. Just like in piranhas, they used to shoot BBs on the top of the water and it would say, oh, there's piranhas in there, because nobody had any footage of real piranhas, you know. But sharks are pretty scary, but, you know.
Right, but it was, which is what I'm saying, is there, it should be easier to make.
It's hard to make those movies. That's why they don't make them.
Sure, because you have to go in the water.
It's all in animals, right? So, but what was that one movie with the girl who was stranded on that rock?
The Shallows, isn't it?
The Shallows.
Yeah, that was not bad.
That was actually pretty good, and 47 Meters Down was pretty good.
It was pretty good, yeah.
There's also the one with Mandy Moore, 47 Meters Down, where she's actually trapped underwater with sharks. Have you seen that?
No, but my point is that the reason you don't see more of these pictures is because they're very difficult to make.
Oh, no, I agree. But it just seems that when they do make them, they're usually not frightening, which...
No, especially Sharkonado. Or whatever
Sharknado.
Sharknado, yes.
We have like from Tara Reid.
And yet there's 40 of those things now.
Yeah, I know, it's crazy. I mean, I thought the first one was actually so absurd that it was kind of funny. Mm-hmm. It was kind of a trauma-like experience where you feel like, really? And you can have a blast watching stuff like this if you're just in the right mood, right? But then it turned out to be like completely shit.
Well, now it's a genre, you know.
Yeah.
Piranaconda, and you know, there's all those pictures that Corman made with have the funny titles, and they're all made for Sci-Fi Channel.
Yeah. For nothing.
For nothing.
There's one I can't remember. Is it Mega Shark or it?
Mega Shark versus
Giant Octopus.
Something.
And the giant shark leaps out of the water and eats a 747.
The titles come first.
Yeah.
Then the poster, then the movie.
Some good films have come out
tradition.
Of that model, yes.
Yeah, I was a teenage werewolf.
Yes, or Hollywood Boulevard. All right, well, what's next on your list, sir?
No, well, if we go to Citizen Kane, I mean, it's a lot, of course. But I bring it up because it was so funny. I just watched on Netflix that Trump doku, right? Where what is your favorite film? He said Citizen Kane. And then they ask him, what is your message or what you sing about? And he said, look, money alone doesn't make you happy, as you see in the relationship between Citizen Kane, like Kane and the wife. And then what is your solution? He said, get another wife. And it was actually, I was laughing. I saw for a moment he actually understood Citizen Kane. But his solution is, get the fuck with the wife, like, get out of it. I mean, it was so funny. I couldn't believe it. And so the great scene of Citizen Kane for me was, of course, always when he finished the review about his wife, the newspaper review, where he actually sticks to the truth and like trashes her into the ground. And that for me made the movie in a way, like the emotional arc of the movie. It was just for me like touching, you know, like it's kind of like it's a kind of a darker movie. We know it's about hers, whatever. But at the same time, I think why it's so interesting, it has a little more in it. What in some masterpieces you cannot explain it, but it's there. Yep. You know, like I don't know. It's like a lot of times when you have the feeling now you watched something important for the film history, but also important for yourself in a way. It's this kind of, it comes, it's almost not explainable with normal film analytic sense, you know. So I had the same with Breaking the Waves from Lars von Trier. You know, what is a movie? I'm not the biggest Lars von Trier fan, to be honest. I think he's kind of a crazy person. And I think a lot of his movies are actually crap. But Breaking the Waves, I watched that in Cologne in a movie theater, and I was absolutely blown away. It was just like this kind of like, I mean, the idea that the guy cannot walk anymore, and he can only walk if his wife basically throws herself out as a prostitute and sleeps with massive people getting raped, whatever. So as more the wife suffers, he recovers. And in the end, he can walk and the wife is dead. I mean, you have to come to an idea like this. I mean, that is like just unbelievable. And a very tough movie, but I think also that was a masterpiece. I mean, it really got me. Emotionally also.
Yeah, he's an interesting filmmaker too, because I'm with you. Some of his films just leave me absolutely cold, and some of them just wreck me for days. I don't know. Were you a fan of Melancholia?
No.
Oh,
I like that one.
That really got me.
I think what you have with the Danish filmmakers a lot of times is they're getting famous, then they're getting all the actors they want, and then they're getting pretentious, and they're getting this kind of arty, you know. So where I had the same, I was here on set, my producer here, I worked in Vancouver with, he produced also who did Fast, the Festen, like the Fast. Oh. Like
Festen?
Yeah.
Oh, God.
Michael Winterbottom, or what? It was a Danish guy.
Festen. Yeah, is it? The Feast. Yeah, sorry. Yeah, the Celebration. The Celebration. Thomas Vinterberg.
Thomas Vinterberg. So, and as you know, he made, after he got a movie done with Sean Penn.
Right.
And of course, when you see like the Celebration movie, how emotional it was a great movie, right? Yeah. And it worked only because they did it like a theater play.
Yeah.
Everybody could play that movie in a day, you know, like, so, and so he came out of a very good movie, very good actors, in his mother language, and then was thrown into that Hollywood thing where he learned, like, some actors think it's strategically good. And then I think I had the same feeling with Lars von Trier, with some of his movies, where he got, like, Kirsten Dunst and all that people, and Nicole Kidman, and it's like, because the agents told them, oh, you have to do like a European arthouse movie with the hottest guy in Europe right now. And that was at that point Lars von Trier, you know. So, I mean, yeah, but I mean, it's an interesting, I think an interesting story.
Yeah. So, well, Vinterberg bounced back, at least. And he did a film a couple of years ago I loved with Mads Mikkelsen called The Hunt.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah.
Which was terrific. So he did manage to recover from his sojourn to America.
But that's seems tough. To be... A lot of times European directors do not recover.
Yeah.
They come here, they get heaps of praise on them, and then they are completely undercut by the studio.
Well, I feel like we lionize these foreign filmmakers, then bring them over here, and the first thing it feels like, I mean, I haven't been through this, but I watched the films. I remember it happened with John Woo, and I just got the sense that they've grabbed this great filmmaker who's making movies that they're not capable of making, bring him to America, and then the first thing they do is they decide they're going to teach him how to make movies.
Absolutely. They put you in a box.
And it's,
but they do that with domestic directors as well.
Well, yeah, that's true.
Yeah, but then, a new trend is to have just unknown young directors, right? Where I think, like, all that people, they get, like, the $200 million movies, and you never heard about that name before, or maybe even after. And I sometimes think they're just, like, executioners.
Well, they like to get people who don't know the rules and who don't know what when the studio comes to them and says, this is what we want, do it this way. And they go, oh, okay, I guess that's the way it's done. I guess I'll do it that way. And, you know, that's not a recipe for making good movies.
No, I agree. And it's just like technocrats, right? So people, they know the technical, coming from that CGI background and stuff like this, but they're not really storytellers. And that is one of my biggest problems I have with all that event movies. I'm just not really into it. You know, I'm not into the new Star Wars, the new Star Trek, and they're getting hyped, and everybody talks about it. I think also that is the trend in the last 8 years or whatever, is this kind of the reviewers, the TV stations, the talk shows, they're all acting like they are important movies. You know, for me also Black Panther is not important, only because there are black people playing it, right? So I mean, it's just like the thing's getting a huge thing, but it's still popcorn cinema and nothing else. And they're making things out of it what is just not there. And I think, you know, like, I was walking my dogs, and I thought about, like, when I thought about the Oscars this year, right? Think about a movie like Little Miss Sunshine that was 10 times better as any movie what was nominated this year or last year for the Oscars. Like, Moonlight is a good TV movie, not more at all. You know, but now movies getting prizes or whatever, they have no real importance whatsoever, but they're getting in a trend where everybody jumps on. You know, and that is the thing, but that is, I think, what completely went lost. Like, in earlier years, and going down on my list, right, we do the, of course, the Deer Hunter would be on the list. Apocalypse Now would be on the list. For me, there were, like, groundbreaking movies, they transported also information, like a real message to the world, and information about, like, yes, Vietnam was crazy. You know, it was not only the wrong war, but it was also, like, crazy. It broke a whole generation of people you know, and then, of course, like 20, 30 years later, the Vietnam veterans, who all got completely fucked over by the government. They didn't get paid. They didn't get the medical support, whatever. And then they're standing there with Make America Great Again and voting for Trump, who will take the last bit of Medicaid and everything away from everybody. And, you know, it's like, that is the crazy world. But I think that the crazy world we're in right now is shown in movies like this. And they were important movies.
Well, maybe this audience is getting the movies they deserve.
Yeah, that is true. And
it's a depressing thought.
Well, you know, I mean, the 70s was a time when people were questioning everything. There were a lot of fascinating filmmakers. Studios were making movies that now they would never touch, that would be instant indies. And now, basically, you know, it started with Jaws, where the B picture became the A picture. But now, superhero movies, which were pretty much the lowest rung on the ladder when I was a kid. I mean, the budgets allowed for those pictures were, they were serials, they were the Superman TV series, all done on very low budgets, yeah, all for basically aimed at kids. Now that has become, that's adult entertainment. That is now the cornerstone of our culture. And I've just made a rule, no more movies with people with capes in them. I'm not going to see anybody who's got a cape in a movie unless he's Dracula.
I was about to say, yeah, what if it's Dracula? Or how about Zorro? I had a kind of flash of revelation a few years ago at Comic-Con, which I used to go to regularly many, 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 many years ago as a sort of...
You used to sell comic books then.
Yeah, exactly. And it was sort of a shameful subculture that I was part of.
Well, it was an outlaw subculture, but yeah. now it's the culture.
Well, what I realized looking around last time is this is what happens when a species loses its natural predator. Is it's just taken over everything. As far as my mother now knows about Comic-Con because it's covered in national media.
Oh, it's like
media.
The Cannes Film Festival.
Yeah, well, what's next on your list?
Going back to the superhero stuff, yes. For one question more, I think also like when I criticize, I mean, nobody cares if I criticize something, but I think they're all in a way indirect. Also, support for the troops, support for the military complex in America, right? Because with Avengers, whatever, it's just the people, like my kids, they believe superheroes are real, right? So, I mean, that is the thing. I mean, not the older one, he's like 10. He doesn't believe it anymore. He knows it's fake, but the younger one. And so, and it's this kind of a lost battle. You know, right. I spent so much fucking money on Transformer Optimus Prime figures or whatever for my kids, and I hate Michael Bay and I hate the movies, you know, but I have no choice. That is the, you know, so, I mean, that is the biggest problem, that they are all showing problems getting solved by violence. With, you know, there is no question that there is a battle, no question there is a war. It's like, and this in an overwhelming way, in a way, I think makes people also like Trump happening, makes this kind of a normal situation. You always have some bombing somewhere, you know, like whatever the world is like. You have here a civil war and then you throw some bombs and then you do this, or you give weapons first to the Taliban, then the Taliban hates you, then you have to fight the Taliban. You know, it's like this endless loop of acceptance of we clear everything up with weapons. And in a superhero way, they hope for something special to solve all the problems. You need Iron Man. You know, whatever you need, you need that special, not the Navy SEALs. We need to go higher. We need to get people that have superpower. And I think that is the biggest threat right now, in a way, what we're doing with our children, because all of this other ideas about how society can be and how like countries can be or whatever, like all that stuff, what I think we got from that older movies we grew up with is gone.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah, and that is the thing where I feel also like a lot of the actors, they just grab the money and run, right? So they think like, Robert Downey Jr. is a great actor. We know he's a great actor, right? So, but at one point he made the decision, I want to make $200 million in the next 10 years, and he's making them. So, you know, I don't know. It's a kind of a sad story. Most of the movies running are not interesting for me at all anymore.
And to get back to what you were saying a minute ago, a friend of mine just pointed out to me recently, the new Avengers film, the title is Infinity War. Which is essentially been America's foreign policy for my entire life. We're infinitely at war, and it just seems to be a way of selling this. So here's a question to you, and it's going to sound like a challenge, and I don't mean it that way, because I myself write, I share a lot of these views, and I write movies that engage with violence and so forth. But you make, you know, for instance, the Rampage films or Assault on Wall Street. These are films that use violence to essentially address problems as well. But there is a difference. And I wonder, can you kind of enunciate that difference? Because I struggle with that all the time, between what you're talking about in kind of mainstream films and yet what you're trying to do with your own movies.
Yeah, I mean, with Assault on Wall Street, what I was interested in, why I there are also movies I wrote, the video game-based movies I never wrote, but there are movies I wrote. And I felt, how can it be that we have 7,000 suicides after the foreclosures and everything. Like 7,000 Americans killed themselves in 4 years, and they all lost their houses, they lost their existence in the banking crisis. And at the same time, we have nobody going to jail. We have even like 2008, you know, that was like, okay, now we have to regulate the banks, blah, blah, blah. And nothing got done. And people like Richard Fuld from Lehman Brothers have got $400 million out of Lehman Brothers. Lehman Brothers went under, you know, with $800 billion in debt, and the taxpayers have to shoulder it in a way. They moved it all to the bad banks. Why, if we have shootings every day in America, every day? I mean, how many schools we want to shoot up, right? But why nobody ever went to Wall Street and really shoot that people? I mean, that, there's a lot of news. But I think it's a good question, because are they so scared to just kick the door in at Lehman Brothers or Goldman Sachs, whatever, and shoot the way up and shoot the CEO, or don't go to a public appearance? I mean, that is the same. But we have so many, even the political motivated, more ISIS people, whatever, running amok. They did it on military bases. They, you know, like, but it's not like really existing. And I got criticized. I said, yeah, probably basically say that they should go and shoot the bankers. And I said, for a movie, I want to scare the bankers. I want that the bankers watch my movie and think, maybe I was only lucky so far that I didn't get shot in my favorite Manhattan restaurant, you know, drinking Chateau Lafite. So, I mean, you know, like, so, but that was the, I think that was, I tried to do the movie the opposite to Wall Street 2. You know, I think Wall Street 2 is just rich pricks are whiny about their existence, but there was nobody who actually lost anything for real in Wall Street 2. And then I put in the sound of Wall Street that his wife kills herself because they cannot pay the medical bills anymore. You know, and that is the point what drives him over the edge, where he thinks like, you know what, fuck it. I go after them and shoot them. And I think that is totally understandable. It's still murder. But I mean, if you lose everything and you can now be a homeless guy at the street corner, or you strike back, that, I mean, what do you want to do, right? So, and I think what a lot of people see, and the crazy thing is this, we had Bernie Sanders who tried to do a revolutionary thing and he didn't get even nominated. And you have Trump who said, I'm doing a revolutionary thing, but all the wrong things. But he got, I think, elected because the people wanted that revolutionary thing. Yeah. You know, and I think that is an overall tendency, I think, in the society right now, in Europe and the US, that the people feel the injustice. But they maybe vote then exactly in the wrong, I mean, Trump told everybody, I take care of you, blah, blah, blah. He was lying and lying and lying. And his politic is only to make the rich richer and the poor poorer. So, but the people don't know that.
Right.
You know, because there is kind of a fascist channel with Fox News. What is, you know, when they all criticize now the Russian TV channels, I mean, Fox News is like a Russian TV channel in America, just spreading out lies, blurring the facts. And that should be shut down, or it should be like written advertising on the channel. And I think it's a dangerous situation where we're moving, and the movie industry doesn't help. It doesn't really point thing out. And I think with Rampage, what was a different thing, because it's like a three-part miniseries spread over 8 years where we follow a domestic terrorist, basically, in Rampage. But I think Brandon Fletcher did a great job there, because he is a murderer, he is a mass murderer, but he points out the right points, right? He said, like, there will be no a non-violent solution because we are sold out to the rich. Like the lobbyists and in Washington and whatsoever, and they control in the very end. You can pick if you get controlled by the oil and weapon industry and the Republican, you know, like the Republican fossil fuel people, or you are controlled by the Wall Street and more Silicon Valley parties when the Democrats are in power, and that is what that guy in Rampage is saying and doing, and it's a point. You know, it's like it's not done anymore. I think the U.S. has a massive problem because there are only two parties, and the election process is it's either or. Like in any other country, in Canada, in Germany, whatever, you have to build coalitions. You have to, you know, you have like four or five parties. They're all getting 10, 20, 30%. So you have this kind of a force like Merkel now has to work with the Social Democrats in Germany. And they force her to do more for the labor force, to do more social security, to do more for the medical thing, because she didn't get 50%, right? So as an example, and Merkel is already like a middle conservative. She's not a right wing. She's more in the middle. But every country normally has this kind of different influences who in the end try to make politics for the majority of the people in the country. But I think that is in U.S. absolutely not the case.
Well, it's exacerbated by the fact that in the U.S. 60% of the people don't vote.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
But
why do you think they don't vote? Because they're zero interested, or they're just forgetting it that it's the vote day or whatever?
I think they're largely not interested. I think those of us who follow politics and tend to live in a certain bubble where we think that everybody is thinking about the things that we're thinking about, and a lot of people are just thinking about how they're going to pay their bills, you know. And there's a large portion of the country, as exemplified by the Tea Party a few years ago, that basically doesn't like change, doesn't like progress. It wants to go back. It wants to go back to the 1950s, and where people knew their place, and there was segregation, and these things are not coming back. See, the fly in the ointment is that, you know, they don't like immigration. Too bad. There's a lot of people who are here. It's a country of immigrants, and they're never going to not be a country of immigrants, no matter how they try. And the future is the young people. And if you look at the school walkouts that we had, and the gun control stuff, I mean, these are things that are spearheaded by young people. And that's the only hope that this country has, is that these people are eventually going to get, you know, old enough to vote and get rid of some of these old farts who just want to line their pockets at everybody's expense.
But I would also say it's easy to keep people from voting if you continue to just kind of...
No, I wasn't even talking about the efforts that they make to legitimately stop people from voting. I'm talking about people who just aren't interested in voting.
Oh, no, but I'm saying
all.
It's easy to keep people at home by just continuing to feed them this sort of hopelessness and despair.
Well, that's what they do at Fox. I mean, you know, they just don't cover stories that they don't want people to know. Yeah. And then
I think also, what the new dimension is, what Trump brought, is that denial of facts. Mm-hmm. You know, like, I think, like, let's take a Bush. I hated George Bush Jr. I hated him, right? I think totally corrupt, made up the weapons of mass destruction, a crime. He should be charged for it, whatever. But they would not go so far to say the earth is flat and when you remember... When Trump is doing the trade talks, he says Canada has a huge surplus in trading with U.S. It's just not true. It's not true, and it's in the U.S. budget. Like, you know, it's the opposite. Like, U.S. sells more to Canada as Canada to U.S. So, and nobody at Fox said it's total bullshit, or somebody to Trump or the what is it, the PR, the press secretary, Sarah Huckabee Sanders, whatever. She defends total lies.
She is an accomplished liar. And, you know, we are now governed in our country by Fox News. He gets up in the morning. The first thing he does is turn on his favorite television show with these three mooks sitting there staring at the camera, telling him what he should do that day. And he does it. And he goes out and he literally, word for word, tweets what these people tell him to tweet. I mean, this is not a normal situation. I don't think even Orwell envisioned this particular scenario.
It is the next step beyond
that.
I would point out, I mean, George W. Bush was a climate change denier, though. I mean, this is not the first time we've had people who believe in absolute garbage in the White House. It's just the most extreme version, I think.
Yeah, but usually some of them had one or two redeeming characteristics. This guy is a dangerous lunatic, and he is at the most powerful position in the entire world, and nobody is doing anything about it. That's what I find astonishing. And the people who are supposed to be behind him, his grand old party, which now is in tatters because it's now the Trump party, and all of the normal people in the party have left. They're all quitting. The ones that are dare to say anything bad immediately are scared away, and they're not gonna, because of, quote, the base. The base is 30% of the country that is running the other 70% of the country. And I don't understand how that works.
Yeah, and it's exactly how you say. Like, you remember when he visited Duterte in the Philippines, and then he came back and was asking for the death penalty for everybody.
Yeah. For drug dealers, yeah.
Oh, yeah, no, and we need more death penalties. So it's like whatever, whoever basically talks to him, if he goes to North Korea, he comes back completely brainwashed, right? Yep. They will just say, look, we are the good guys, you're the bad guys, so it doesn't make any sense. Whatever, like, but, and then he comes back, oh, we have a great relationship with Kim Il-sung. 2 weeks later, it will all turn 180 because Kim Il-sung Twitter, whatever, Trump is bald, he has a wig on.
And
then everything is over. It's like a third world war, right? So and that is my biggest problem. It's like that. I don't think that the Bush Jr., who was maybe the weakest after Trump as a president, would go so balloony. And, you know, like on everything. And also George Bush Jr. didn't put, like, on top of the EPA a climate change denier. He maybe denied the climate, but the EPA was still, like, full of scientists.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and that is the big difference. Trump exchanged everybody into like Scott Pruitt, but like completely absurdity. He made a massage therapist the chef of an agency with 38,000 people because nobody else wanted to do it anymore. And the massage therapist was maybe in his room right now, and he felt, who can grab me like this? Can whatever leave the agency? Wait, I have to open the door for my dog. Wait, yeah, just to get up. So. That I think that is the thing. What is unseen, and but we're already. I have already the feeling, CNN and everybody, they gave up. You know, I have this kind of feeling that they basically felt like they do everything against Trump every day, but in a way, the energy is already out of Anderson Cooper. And
well, it's exhausting covering a guy who's crazy. You know, it's, you don't know what he's going to do. He's got people. He's got his caddy running the country. He's insane. He's enabled by people who are afraid of him, and he's about as powerful as his hairdo.
But was that you?
That's mine. Sorry.
But, you know, the problem also
my
is,
dog calling me.
You know, CNN and so forth still make the mistake of talking about him. They don't know how to talk about someone like him, so they still put him in this context of, you know,
they try to talk about him like he's a normal politician, like he's like
yeah.
He's
watching Wolf Blitzer try to contextualize the president's decision today as though there's, you know, he's a rational politician instead of a syphilitic old narcissist.
He's completely irrational, and it's a crime that this guy has been allowed to continue on as long as he has.
So what's your next movie, Uwe?
The only two guys I love to watch every week on HBO is John Oliver and Bill Maher. They don't give up, right? They don't give up hoping for common sense that he gets indicted. You know, I mean, any other president would be already like, he did 20 different things you could indict him for, but nobody cares. It has all no consequences.
If right? Barack Obama did even one of those things, he would have been out on his ear.
Yeah. You know, you remember when he, before he turned president, where everybody said, if he doesn't put his companies out of his name in a third party trust, he cannot be president.
Right.
And what he did, nothing. He gave a shit. He just didn't change it at all. Right. So, and it had no consequences because there was no attorney, no Democratic Party doing something about it. And that is the thing. I mean, for example, if he throws Mueller out, right, I think the FBI should go in and arrest him.
Well, you're not alone in that belief. And I think if that happened, and of course we don't know when this is going to be broadcast, but
also the president is not above the law, right? So I mean, that is the thing. If it's a dictator. That is what Bill Maher always said. All the things what a dictator is doing, Trump basically has already like from 10 things, 8 marks on it.
All his favorite world leaders are dictators. I mean, he wants to be like Putin. He wants to be like Duterte. He likes that idea. He likes the idea of just getting everything done the way he did in his business. I want this done, and it's done. You know, yep. nobody to answer to. And that's why he doesn't take anybody's advice. It doesn't matter who's in the cabinet, the worst cabinet in history. But yep. it doesn't matter because he makes personally all the decisions. And as people in his employ find out, he'll tell them something, they'll go out and say it, and then he'll completely deny it and undercut them and throw them under the bus because he changed his mind.
Yeah.
I will say two things. I don't know quite when this will drop, but and I don't know if it'll happen before then or after, but he will fire Mueller and nothing will come of it.
There will be demonstrations.
Yeah, there will be demonstrations. The investigation will continue. I think he's going to fire him. And the other thing, the only thing I would point out, and I'm not defending him, but I mean, the death count and the destruction done just to this country, let alone the world, by the Bush administration dwarfs anything Trump has done.
Yet.
And that's the thing, I think. It's the potential.
I don't know. This EPA thing is pretty bad.
You can't
undo that stuff. Once you pour the stuff in the lake, it's there.
But the good thing is we've already destroyed the environment. We only have about 30 years left regardless.
Well, you know, and that's Stephen Hawking thought we should go to another planet. And all I can think of is, well, we haven't finished ruining this one. We're going to mess up another one.
The Mars says thank you already in advance.
I'm Jane Perlez, longtime foreign correspondent and former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. I've been a foreign correspondent in lots of places, Somalia, Indonesia, Pakistan, but nowhere as important to the world as China.
I mean, China is not dropping anti-democratic paratroopers into Montana. But of course, we did see things like the weather balloon / spy balloon riveting the whole country for a week.
This is Face Off, an 8-part series in which we'll take you behind the scenes to key moments in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. We'll speak with a diplomat, a spy, a tech reporter, a U.S. admiral, even Yo-Yo Ma. Plus, my pal and noted China historian Rana Mitter joins the conversation. We'll look at what's driving the two nations apart and explore whether anything can help bring them back together. Face Off launches April 9th.
So, but another movie is that will be flat.
Ladies and gentlemen, I've traveled over half our state to be here tonight. I couldn't get away sooner because my new well was coming in at Coyote Hills and I had to see about it. Ladies and gentlemen, if I say I'm an oil man, you will agree. I'm a family man. I run a family business. This is my son and my partner, H.W. Plainview.
You boys are a regular family business.
Now, you have a great chance here.
My son is a healer and a vessel for the Holy Spirit. He has a church.
You will be cast up and thrust back to perdition.
I'm fixed like no other company in this field. I have a string of tools ready to put to work. That's why I can guarantee to start drilling and to put up the cash to back my word. I assure you, ladies and gentlemen, no matter what the others promise to do, when it comes to the showdown, they won't be there.
Paul Thomas Anderson, I think, started very strong with Boogie Nights, and Magnolia was good, but Boogie Nights, I love Boogie Nights. And I think There Will Be Blood was for me the best movie in the last like 10, 12 years at all. I think it's an amazing movie. Daniel Day-Lewis at his best. And it's about greed.
Yeah.
Right? So it's really like, I think it's a good title, and where that priest, Paul Dano, or whatever the actor is, was extremely well done. Very dark, but very real in a way. And I was blown away. I mean, that was an absolute masterpiece. And then he did the same. He went the same route down, like Terrence Malick went down. You know, like where you just watch the last three or four movies he did, and you think like, what the fuck happened to that guy? He has nothing to say anymore.
I'm going to defend him on one film. I avoided Phantom Thread like the plague. I've never seen a trailer.
That was very wise of you.
2.5-minute long trailer that felt like an hour and a half. But no, then I finally saw the film.
The worst ending of a movie.
Oh my God! I absolutely. We might come to blows, Joe.
I couldn't believe how much I loved that film. It's a bad Alfred Hitchcock Presents episode.
It's
to have that gigantic buildup to an ending which I people might not have seen it, so I can't say it, but it's an ending that is psychologically false and preposterously stupid, and to expect that anybody could believe the actions of these characters in this movie is I'm sorry.
Well, it leaps
it's like his last picture, which is all close-ups. You know, it's like I don't know what happened to the guy.
All I will say is, and this may give you more insight into him, is I thought Phantom Fred and that ending stayed with me forever. I think it's one of the most terrifyingly honest movies ever made about marriage. And I'm happily married. I'm saying that as a.
I hope that doesn't portend anything.
I look at this movie. It got Oscar nominations because of Daniel Day-Lewis said it's my last movie. You know, I mean, after a movie like this, it's maybe the right decision. You know, maybe it was because
the two of you
want to play in other movies anymore. You know, but it's this kind of
so popular.
Yeah, but then it's the same what I said with Terrence Malick. I mean, how many times you want to have people walking at the beach, looking at each other, you know, or going over a field, and I mean, like, what the fuck, you know, like it doesn't make any sense. And also, if you're a good actor, like Michael Fassbender and all that people, Ben Affleck, you know, they could also like totally, instead of saying to him, you know, Terrence, if you go backwards and you start making good movies again. No, the actors are stupid. They don't see that the movies are total crap and that guy, whatever, uses money to blow it. But you know, like, but a normal actor who knows about filmmaking should tell him it will be boring. Nobody gives a shit about two people smiling at each other in slow-mo at the beach for 25 minutes, and it leads to nothing, and it starts to nothing. You have no connection to his people in the movie. Zero emotional connection. And that is the amazing thing, is then because he gets, like, the superstars playing with him, then getting invitations to Cannes, getting invitations to Berlin, you know, because they want Ben Affleck on the red carpet, whatever. And instead of saying, like, are you crazy? You know, like Thomas the Train is more entertaining for adults.
I will just last thing. I really disagree with both of you extremely about Phantom Thread. But I will say this. Here's my other prediction. Robert Mueller will be fired and Daniel Day-Lewis will continue to make movies. That is my
prediction. I believe that Daniel Day-Lewis will be picked to head the investigation.
Oh, there you go. That would be two birds with one stone. Uwe, do you have one more film on your list that you can give us in the time we have, or?
Dances with Wolves.
Says here that you've been decorated and they sent you here to be posted.
Actually, sir, I'm here at my own request.
Why?
I've always wanted to see the frontier.
Do you want to see the frontier?
Yes, sir. Before it's gone.
There ain't nothing here, Lieutenant. Everybody's run off or got killed.
What about Indians?
Totally different, right? So, I think that was also a movie what really got me emotionally like a heavy hitter, a great epic film. And Kevin Costner, who I met later for my movie In the Name of the King, and he's kind of a prick. And basically, Kurt Russell and Christian Slater told me the same about working with him, that he's kind of a prick. And my producer here, Dan Clark, he was the assistant from Clint Eastwood on the Perfect World movie. Mm. And he said also there, Costner also didn't came out of his trailer. And then Eastwood started shooting without him, scenes like where Costner was in. And then he told him, like, if you're not there, I shoot without you. And then that made him coming out of his trailer. But in like 3,000 miles to Graceland, Kurt Russell and Christian Slater, they always had to wait. And he didn't came, and they were like standing on their marks, and were ready to go, and nothing happened for 10 minutes, and so he treated everybody like shit. But Kevin Costner in Dances with Wolves, yes. I think, amazing film, for me, total masterpiece, deserved all the Oscars, me as a Western fan, I was happy to see a movie like this.
Yeah, I think he gets that's kind of dissipated in time, its reputation, I think. And
well, all movies dissipate in time.
Well, no, I mean, some sort of people grow in stature as time goes on. But one of the things I like about that, and I might be the only person on the planet who likes The Postman.
You probably are.
Is that they are. I'll take it. They're both very old-fashioned Hollywood kind of epic films, mm-hmm. unabashedly and unashamedly. And I think a lot of people missed that with Dances with Wolves. They thought it was something else. But I think it works in the context of those kind of classic epic Hollywood westerns.
In The Postman, the emotional arc was not there. What you have in Dances with Wolves, with the wolf, but also with his wife, right? So, I mean, it's an amazing love story in it. And I think a great movie. I like Robin Hood more as The Postman.
Oh, I know, sir. The Kevin Costner Robin Hood?
Well, I consider it the Alan Rickman Robin Hood. He's the only good thing in it.
Yeah, it was better.
I think there's a thing, somebody said this, it should be a rule, because I was not enjoying Robin Hood that much, and then they bring out Sean Connery. And I think the worst thing you can do in a movie is remind people of a better movie about the same subject, because I was almost accepting Robin Hood, and then they bring out the star of Robin and Marian, and it just a vastly superior film.
It's not that I like Robin Hood, but yes. I really disliked Postman.
Okay,
I think they're totally not in the same. I would give Dances of Wolves 10 out of 10 and The Postman 3 out of 10.
See, he should have rung twice.
Do you have one more, or shall we?
No, on my list was, of course, also The Godfather Part 2. And I mean, Part 1, I loved both, right? So, but who doesn't love that movie?
Yes. Yeah.
So, I mean, it's just like an absolutely classic. Always, also a movie that doesn't age. Like Jaws, you can watch The Godfather. You will never switch it off. It's super entertaining. And then there are movies like, whatever, Titanic. You watch in the movie theater, you see it the first time, you think, wow, what a big movie, what a great movie. And then you see it again, and you never want to see it. You switch it off after 5 minutes. Like, unwatchable. And I think a lot of movies like this are basically this kind of unwatchable after you watched them already.
Yeah, movies of the moment as opposed to movies for all time.
Yeah.
Sure. Uwe, thank you so much for joining us. It's been a real pleasure talking about movies and a little sideline into politics there.
A little sideline,
half an hour. But it was a wonderful conversation.
Thank you very much for doing it.
Thank you for sharing your thoughts.
Thanks for inviting me. Come back anytime.
Oh, by the way, and I should plug this. I'm not sure when we'll drop, if this will happen, but really, Uwe's challenged Alex Jones to a boxing match. I hope that happens. I know who I would put my money on, because I've seen you box film critics. I support that endeavor.
But that he forced Alec Baldwin to a boxing match and stuff like this, right? And then he takes like steroids and stuff like this. And I despise him, right? I think it's very good that the Sandy Hook people now suing him, like mm-hmm. the parents. But for me, I mean, he's a climate change denier. He's a right corner fascist. But to say to parents, your kids didn't get killed.
Oh, he's a monster.
It's unbelievable. You
know, I would be the parent. I would track him down. I would did that already. And what you know, like that is the thing. But I felt, you know what? If he has so a big mouth, it's interesting. His ex-wife is twittering all over it. Like, Alex, go in the ring, go in the ring.
Oh.
He also steal money, whatever. So let's do it as a charity boxing fight, and all the revenues, the winner decides what happens to the revenues. And I said my money goes to the victims of shootings, right? So like of course his money would go to the NRA or whatever, to the Koch brothers or to himself. And so I said, like, we put that on the line. I think there would be some streaming revenues or whatsoever and ticket sales. But of course, he's not answering, because all this kind of people are always pussies. You know, they're always in the very end, not like this kind of, you know, they don't have it in them. That is the same with when I was young, I boxed 14 years at Bayer Leverkusen, right? So, and our coach was Fritz Stunek, who trained the Klitschkos later. So we were a few times German, like amateur champs. So I'm out of shape. I'm 52, so I have to go back to training, but I would do it, you know? But I know how it feels to get punched in the face. And that is what you learn in boxing. Is not like, I mean, everybody can swing some shots, whatever, you know, and you can be like flipping out. But you learn the real thing if you do the real thing. And so I'm not scared to be in the ring with Alec Jones because he couldn't take the pressure. You know, that it's true. Like, if you're not used to it and you get really punched in the face, and the referee doesn't stop it, and there is no like TV host who stops it, then you will have a very good experience for the rest of your life. And that is what I want to give it to him. So let's do it. I go back to training. He's pumped up. He's heavier as me. He's younger as me.
He's a large man, yeah.
Yeah, so, and I said, yeah, but I fight for the good thing. And I go to Texas. They can have like 80,000 Ku Klux Klan members in the stadium. I go there and fight him. I'm not scared. So he should do it.
He should, absolutely. He should do it. Joe, I mean, would Trailers from Hell officially endorse that?
I would certainly endorse that.
Well, good luck with
that. Go on the trailer.
He should answer. He should say, I'm not doing it because I'm a pussy, or I do it, right? So, but he should admit to his fan base that his screaming and being like that tough guy is a facade.
Of course it is. He's crazy. Yes. It's an act. It's all an act.
Well, good luck with that. And the new Rampage film is now out streaming. Is that correct?
It's on Netflix.
On Netflix, yes. And so good luck with that. And thank you so very much for joining us, sir.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you so much.
Bye.
Take care.
Thank you.
Our show is recorded in Hollywood, California, at the crossroads of the world. We are the official podcast of TrailersFromHell.com, the best damn movie website there is. Our engineer is Don Barrett, who also wrote, produced, and created our theme song. This is Josh Olson for The Movies That Made Me.
Want to learn how you can make smarter decisions with your money? Well, I've got the podcast for you. I'm Sean Piles, and I host NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. Our show features our team of nerds, personal finance experts in credit cards, banking, investing, and more. And they'll help you make the most of your money while cutting through the clutter and misinformation in today's world of personal finance. You'll get clarity on strategies to help you build your wealth, invest wisely, shop for financial products, and plan for major life events. Listen to NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.